First thing I want you to do is I want you to take your book, and I want you to take a pen. This is an exercise. You see this little white space at the top? I want you to put your name on it. Because you're going to leave it somewhere. I know you're better than men at men's retreats, but at least they'll know whose book it is, since they all look alike. Once you have your name on it, I want you to open the cover. And I dedicated this to my wife, Emily, my first love, the wife of my youth, nurturer of our first five poems, David, Jessica, Becky, Jenny, and Katie, not to mention our now six grandchildren. So that's her in Norway in she was 19. And then the bottom picture is her with her first granddaughter. I wrote, I am Jacob, the dreamer of dreams, but while my mind is in heaven, my head lay upon the stone, you build the ladder that brings heaven home. That's my wife, German, methodical, order, wonderful. Now, turn to the next page. And on the left, you'll notice it says that further messages can be downloaded of Psalms and Samuel at www.pbc.org. My whole life has been a gift. I went to Stanford to be a stockbroker, and I was a brand new Christian, and I asked our college pastor if he would teach a Bible study in my frat house. So only one other Christian in the house, and I wanted to be in a frat house with guys, because I grew up with women. Even the dog was female. So we got in the house, and David said, no, I'm not going to do that. I said, why not? He said, I'm going to teach you, and you're going to teach it. And I thought he died. I said, I don't know anything. I'm the new guy in the house. I'm shy. He says, no, you're going to invite me to dinner, and we're going to, after dinner, have a team meeting with all the guys in the house, and you're going to share your testimony, and then I will share the gospel, and then you're going to announce you're going to teach a Bible study every Tuesday night. And I will meet with you a week beforehand and teach you the text. I did not sleep for a week. And so he met with me every Tuesday. His little red Volkswagen would pull up to the Thetadale house, and he'd open up the scriptures. In the first year, we did John, first quarter. And I prayed that four guys would come to Christ, and four guys came to Christ. Second quarter, we did Romans 1 to 8, and then I took off to Italy for 6 months, to Stanford in Italy, and with 80 students, and this is 1970, when the war in Vietnam was at full swing, and everybody's protesting and smoking pot and dropping acid, and I'm going to stand up at dinner and say, we're going to have a Bible study. And I got there a week late, so I missed the orientation because I had a gymnastic meet, and I didn't know anybody, but I just felt this burden to teach again, and so I grabbed the mic. I said, I'd like to teach a Bible study, and 15 people showed up. I had the same results. First three or four people came to Christ, and it was so much fun. And that was sort of the life-changing encounter for me, and so then I decided that, this is just to write my dad a Father's Day letter. Because when you go to college, you always share with your parents what you're learning. And my folks aren't Christians. They had a Mormon background that they hated, so they were agnostic. And I was the apple of my father's eye. I have three older sisters, 13 years older, 11 years older, 3 years older. And when he got his boy, I was just the apple of his eye. And I loved my dad to death. Although he never spoke, he had three words, and he all prayed for his blessings. He had such authority as a surgeon. He was the old school surgeon, did anything below the neck. He was probably one of the best surgeons in Los Angeles, very renowned. And I really respected him and honored him, even though I never saw him, because he was so dedicated to his work. So I wrote my dad this Father's Day letter and told him that I loved him and I appreciated how he had sacrificed for us as a family, and my whole life's been a gift. And I said, now I've met Jesus. And then just as I followed you, I want to be at my father's business as I get older. And you're waiting for the return, right? But it never comes. And then I get this postcard in the mail from my mother. Da 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 da. P.S. Knock off the religion, your father's worried. Well, that communicated a mountain of emotion. And what happened that night is my dad went to the dinner table, it was Father's Day, and he said, I've lost my one and only son. And the wall went up for 20 years. And it was really hard for him because after I get the Stanford degree, right? And he sat me down. The only time we ever had a real conversation, because we didn't talk. And emotion especially. So he sat me down and he said, look, Brian, I want to go to Harvard Business School or Stanford Business School, and then if you want to be like Billy Graham, it's fine. But get your master's degree. I thought that's fantastic advice. But I could not take any more of his money. So I decided I wanted to do the most awful thing, which was our church had an intern program where you raise your own support and you minister. And I just wanted to get more Bible teaching, not necessarily be a pastor. And but to my parents, it was the most God-awful cult. Our pastor was like world-renowned. And the miracles that were happening in the Bay Area with the Jesus movement, and our church was exploding. Ray Steadman had written like 25 books. But anyway, so my folks were so devastated that I was doing this that the pastor came to Mary, Emily, and I. And my mother just couldn't have him in the house for the rehearsal dinner, so she threw the pastor out of the house. And we got married, 400 miles away. And after interning, I thought, I really do want to be a pastor. I don't want to get more training. So I applied to seminary. And I had to wait a year because my wife had to get a teaching credential to put me through. Then in the second year, the elder said, hey, you know what? We'll give you all the seminary training you want while you're a pastor. Free of charge. So you stay with us. And I had no idea what that would mean. You know, in some sense, you sense you're selling out because you're not doing the hard educational process. But it was Ray Stebbins' belief that the church ought to be able to equip pastors up and through seminary. So they brought a guy to teach Greek and Hebrew from Dallas Seminary, who was probably the best in the country. And so he tutored us pastors. And then Ray Stebbins knew every scholar in the country. And so I was a scholar stalker. And I would just find the best guys and be making my friends and steal all their stuff. So I have to agree in what I do. But I felt like God has given me the best education you could have had. With Ray Stebbins, we traveled around the world doing pastors' conferences in Africa, Indonesia, Israel. But one of the greatest gifts he did is he introduced me to Bruce Waltke, who's probably the best Hebrew scholar in the country. And I met him at 25. We were in Israel together. And when he opened the Hebrew scriptures, my heart burned. And I said, if that's what he gets to know in Hebrew, I'm going to spend the rest of my life knowing Hebrew. So I would go up and meet with Bruce, and he'd give me like 400 pages of his unpublished stuff on Micah. And he didn't start writing until he was 70. Because he's such a scholar, and he wants to make sure he has something to say. And so he's Hebrew grammars and everything else. But he's been my mentor. So everything you're getting from me about the Psalms has really come from him. But I feel like I have been given gold, and Ray Stebbins introduced us to the best scholars, and so you're getting all of that, and I feel so, I want to give it away before I die. So I want to give you everything, and so that's why it's going to be a little bit taxing this morning, because I want to give you as many frameworks for the Psalms while we're here, and then we'll give you the stories to kind of live it out. But why I put this on this opening page, you can download all our sermons and stuff, www.pbcc.org. And if you want to be on my mailing list, my email is just brian@pbcc.org. And I'll send you all the Psalm stuff as we're doing them yearly. That's my goal, is to get this stuff out. It's all free. And
so is the email address on here, or we need to write it down?
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry.
In the middle of the page, it says, can be downloaded at www.pbc.
Okay.
So my email is just brian@pbcc.org.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And I'll put you on a mailing list and get all my stuff.
Thank you.
Because I feel like Ray Stebbins' belief was in some really basic principles that shaped a revival at our church in the late 70s. One of them was that the pastor was not to do the work of the ministry. He was a trainer, but he also did it to get out of the way. Discipleship was big. Expository preaching was big. And so I'm at a church where there's no full-time preachers. We're all full-time pastors and part-time preachers, so we get to study a text and translate it with a team of people, lay people, scientists, Stanford scholars, whatever, and then live the text, and then it hits the pulpit a year or two later. And it's just such a blessing. And so I haven't burned out in 43 years at the same church because it's been such a healthy place for pastors to grow. And we've always had a team. So you notice I brought two wonderful ladies with me and how impoverished this retreat would be without them. And you'll see the second half of that in a little bit. But when I used to do men's retreats, I would tell the people, look, I am not a conference speaker. If you want me, here's what you're going to get. I'm going to turn you into poets, and we're going to bring a team of people that are going to pay their own way just to come and be with you. And I've had, at times, 20 guys come with me to Canada or Colorado or Texas to be part of something. And the Krizik, it's a symphony. It's not a violin concerto. And when you hear the same stuff, like I learned stuff from Karen last night, every time she says something new, it's we're learning in the car, Kristen is sharing. It's so much fun to learn in community.
Yeah.
Not just one person who's set aside to be the scholar and then pontificates. It's like it's just a community learning together, and we're all growing. And the scholars who taught me had such humility. It was never like, this is the five things and get it straight and dogmatism. It was always, here's the mystery and I'm learning. Now, Walkie's now 83, and he's still like a kid in a candy store. Like, ah, I just learned this today. And he's so humble. He learns from everybody. And that's the spirit, I think, we've gotten from others. That everybody has something to teach you, even non-Christian. I've learned from Stanford professors, because they're all human beings, right? And if they discover truth, let's enjoy it and learn. That's much more than I intended to say. We're only on this page. But I did want to give you a little bit of breakdown of the book, how to use this book. So the whole first section is kind of introductory material. The foreword was done by Karen, and then the surprise by the power of the poem and the encounter was my experience meeting the Romania poet that changed my life. And then we did some of this stuff, and we did the Hannah story. And then I took all of David's Psalms that have superscripts and put them in historical order so you can see how Samuel links up with the Psalter. And then Give Me an Authentic Voice was an entire sermon of what I said last night. The Gift of Lament was done by Karen. And then a very important text, one of the reasons people have trouble with the Psalms is it says, may we smash the enemy's children's heads against the rocks. And you wonder, shall we pray, kill our enemies? And it's a very difficult thing because in the Old Testament we have holy war. And the enemies aren't just enemies because they don't like you. These are the enemies that oppose God's kingdom. And so Bruce Waltke is the only person that I know that's treated that material authentically, so you understand that this was authentic prayer for David, that God was asking David as a king to exercise justice. And God, David is not vindicating himself. He's asking God to exercise justice on his behalf. He's not doing it on his own behalf. And the only difference now is our enemies are spiritual, not physical. There's the world, the flesh, and the devil. And we pray to forgive our enemies with Christ, because the judgment is coming at the end of history. So he works all that through for you, but you can still see the value of they're called imprecatory psalms, but they're really just asking God to do justice. And they love ancient Near Eastern hyperbole. I love hyperbole too, so anyway. And then we did the next two ones. The next big section, Exercises in the Poetry of Lament, is basically the conference, and we're really just doing the Voice of Abandonment this morning, and the Voice of Unspeakable Grief. And that's where we'll be in the exercises to get you into the text to see how the poet is giving voice to his particular situation in that psalm. Okay? Turn the page. And then the invitation to a journey is I took the first 8 psalms and I used them to do process spiritual formation. So to take the psalms devotionally and just to go on a retreat or whatever, and ways to meditate the psalm into your soul. And then reflection, the select psalms. I just put the psalms in poetic form for you, some select ones, especially the ones that Bruce Waukee translated, that you could then do your own poetry out of. And then putting it all together at the end of the book is becoming storytellers and poets. So that's the job of pastors, is to make everybody a storyteller and a poet to have a voice. And so Fathers and Sons is my story with my dad and Emily's stepfather, Grandpa Sid, who was Jewish. A Cousin's Eyes is the story of my daughter when I had the privilege of hearing her voice in Romania. And hearing my daughter's voice was so moving for me. Because it's not something you get until you're dead, right? You're in the grave and then the kid comes and says what's in their heart. And I got to hear it while I was living. And I was so moved emotionally, I thought, this is how God feels when he hears your voice. And it gave me a whole new perspective of how important it is that we craft our voice together and share it and worship. And God is the audience. I mean, as if I'm a dad and a grandpa, and it doesn't take much to move me. And I think, wow, God, just hear your voice, daughters. It's like, ah. And there's nothing like a daughter's voice to a dad, okay? I know God likes guys, but daughters? I'm so glad I had three daughters, you know, but to hear their voice, nothing like it. And then you're getting Elsie's story is mothers and daughters. And then Karen's story, she said she lost a friend last night. It was my friend Jim Ziegler, who died of Lou Gehrig's disease. Right, it's Lou Gehrig's, right? Where he very quick and painful, and Karen played at the graveside with me. So that's her story. So we're just trying to model how we're integrating story and poem as a way to be known. Okay? Any questions? All right. Ready to lunch? So James Garcia, our worship pastor, I had him in my Psalms class, and he put about 15 Psalms to music. And so I thought you'd enjoy hearing Psalm 1. Get us ready. Okay, maestro, play. Psalm 1's on page 86. Thank you. So when I was in Stanford, Italy, I got there and everybody goes, hey, we're going to Rome. It was spring, March. I said, Rome? I said, you know what that way is? Switzerland. So no one went with me, but I went in the morning, got the train to Florence, and at 8 a.m. I was at Zermatt, Switzerland, skiing on a glacier, all above the tree line. Cost me $12 to rent my skis and boots, and I skied. Came back, my face was all dark. Next week, everybody went back skiing to Zermatt. And so there was a lady there who ran our little pension. She says, oh, we should come back and play the Matterhorn. So we had a three-week break, and I just, Emily and I and this other guy, we dropped into Zermatt. And she just grabs me, says, it's 3 p.m, you gotta go now. What? So she drags me to the mountain store, and she's giving me crampons and pitons, the second week of the season for climbing. Get the next slide. And so here's what you need if you're going to climb a mountain and get the view of life, right? You got a guide who knows the way, okay? You need a rope to secure yourself to the guide. And you need a carabiner to attach yourself to the rope, especially when it locks. And then you can go anywhere, right? So, next. So I got in the chairlift. You take the chairlift to the cable car station, 8,000 feet. And then it's a three-hour hike to the hut before you start. And I barely made it. And then you pass the graveyard where everybody died that didn't make it. And on this hike, I get altitude sick. Because I came from Florence, which was sea level. Okay, keep going. And so then here's the hut. You get there at 10,000 feet. I'm exhausted. I'm dizzy. Next slide. I meet my guide. He had climbed this mountain 88 times. He was a no-nonsense guy. And I get my rope, my carabiner. I got crampons. And at 3 in the morning, he wakes you up and he says, okay, now the work begins. That's a very dangerous mountain to climb, but I discovered all I have to do is follow his footsteps. He knows the way. Next. And then halfway point, if you can't make it, you can turn around and go back. And so now you stop and rest and you take in the vista to see where you have been. Okay? And then when you get toward the top, you realize somebody's put the ropes in before you. They're already there. And you just have to go where others have been and you just go slowly up the ascent. Okay? And then, you know, the rope's going to hold you, but it's against your logic. If you lean into the mountain, you hit your forehead against the thing, and you go upside down. If you lean back and trust the rope, you're safe. And it's interesting, the Hebrew word betach means to give God your full weight. And it's used of a baby that's nursing, and you know when a baby's nursing, they lay limp. Give the mother their total weight. So David says, you taught me to betach at my mother's breast. And that's what you have to do when you're mountain climbing or you'll die. Next. And then the guide's hand never lets go, no matter how dangerous, okay? And when you get to the top, it's elation. I still own that sweater. There's a couple holes in it. It's when I had hair. Yeah. Next slide. And now you're taking in the vista. Now this is praise. You just see the glory of God, and you want to sing, okay? And then you get a perspective. That was the glacier I skied on the day below. So if you ever go skiing in Zermatt, you only take two runs. The first one gets you to the ridge, and then you ski down, and you have lunch in Italy, and then you come back up, and you have dinner in Switzerland. Two runs for the whole day. Excellent. And your perspective changes. So that's Zermatt from on top. And what's interesting, when you're on the top of a peak, you realize that none of the cares of the earth below make it up. And one of the Hebrew words for grace and distress is a narrow place where you're hemmed in. And you know what salvation is? It's a broad place where you can breathe. Coming to Durango is like, this is a rahav. You can breathe here. I'm looking out my window of our hosts, and there's, you know, the beautiful 11,000 foot peak in the distance. There's air. In Silicon Valley, we live in a beautiful place, but you know, we're all closed in with technology. Smothered by it. thank God you live here.
Yeah, we do.
Because creation is a very important discipline just to get spiritually connected. Next slide. And what you also notice is that the heavenly reality of this glacier, the weight of that glacier, the massive glacier, forces its weight, and the pressure of heaven is felt on earth, but the cares of earth do not make it to heaven. Next. Now, in the Psalms, we have 1,000 years of prayers, made up of 5 books that go through all Israel's history. It's quite a climb. So if you start at Psalm 1, like Elsie's little group did, and you go to Psalm 150, you do that entire journey. And if you look back on your Psalm 1 on page 86, it has this, blessed is this man. Ish actually doesn't just mean male. It means an individual of a group. And the word blessed, there's 2 different Hebrew words for blessed. One is imparting. When God blesses mankind, it makes your life fertile, abundant life that conquers evil. Okay? So be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. That's the blessing. This word is not that word. It really means, it speaks of someone whose life, they've already done something beautiful and they're being commended for it. Okay? So Psalm 1 is the introduction to the psalm, and it tells us that there's an individual who's already made the climb. And the ropes are already in place. And all you got to do is put your carabiner on there and follow that guide. Yes, it'll be dangerous. It'll be scary. It'll be cold. You'll face a lot of weather. There's crevices. There's ravines. But that's guaranteed success because he's made it. And that Ish is Jesus. So the first prayer is not a prayer. The first prayer tells you a guide climbed the Matterhorn 88 times and he made it. He's going to take you up. You want to go? And he's going to take you the way. It's a well-trodden path of 1,000 years. And not all of it will be your experience. But like in Karen's case, Tamar's experience was her experience. But you'll see some psalms that you'll never get close to the agony that David went through. Being the scum of the earth and slandered forever and, you know, buried. But it's all done. So this is the Psalms. So we get to take this journey, and it's guaranteed success. So why learn to pray anywhere else, right? Next slide. Now it's interesting. You say, so what's the first psalm? If you're going to learn a task, usually if I'm going to learn to swim, I put my little kid in the shallow end where they can paddle, right? And then you hold them, and then, you know. But when we learn to pray, the very first superscript is this. The day my son hates my guts and wants to kill me because I committed a murder and adultery, he did the same thing, and now he's leading a military coup against me. And you go, oh my gosh, that's pretty painful. That's graduate school. How do you know God's loyal love will handle it when you sit in your holy office, your son's repeated your sins, and they want to kill you? How do you know God's going to vindicate you? And I think what it means, it's sort of like, okay, here's what God's going to do. My daughter went to New Zealand, and she went off the largest bungee jump in the world. And so what God's asking you to do in your first psalm, David is standing here over a cliff. It's the longest bungee jump in the world. You're going to strap yourself to David and go off that cliff. And all of a sudden you go past, he sees Bathsheba, he takes Bathsheba, he commits adultery, he brings Uriah home once, he brings Uriah home twice, he sends a letter to kill Uriah. More people are killed than just Uriah. And he's redefined good and evil. And you're almost ready to face the abyss, and all of a sudden, you're weightless. God's loyal love holds. Now, if the rope can hold for that, I guarantee you there's no one in this room that will be a little outcast shepherd to be made the king of the nation and commit murder and adultery and use holy war to kill your best friend and still be forgiven. So if the rope holds for that, it'll hold for anything. And so it gives you this sense, okay, let's test the rope. The most magnificent test I can do is that first song. And so now you feel secure that you can hold the rope. It's amazing. What a school book. Who teaches like this? Only God. Okay, next slide. So I'm going to show you how the psalm works. So now we're on page 49. Okay. And we're going to do the voice of abandonment. And the theory that we talked about last night, I'll show you how it works in this psalm. I like to use this psalm because it's only 7 verses. You know what this tells you? You don't have to pray long. It's really nice for people with ADD like me. And remember what Jesus said? Don't be repetitive. Which then, if you're into rosaries, it's a no-no. It's also insulting to God to have to repeat it over and over again to say that you would hear me. It's like a dad, you know, when the daughter comes, says, can I have your ear, Dad? And now you're face to face, we're talking to each other, and she says to me,
Dad,
yeah.
Dad, will you listen? Dad, will you listen?
I'm here, daughter. And then she gives me this request, and so this dad cries when she gives the request, and then she does it again, and again, and again, 1,000 times. What is that saying about the relationship? It's not a human relationship. So the first thing Jesus, don't pray. That's what the pagans do. You don't have to pray much. Just pray well. Just be thoughtful. You only need 7 verses if you feel abandoned. Wow. Okay. Marilyn. Where's Marilyn? My reader. Okay.
You're doing a great job.
So, you know, in my book, page 49, you're going to read the 1 Samuel background. Now, let me tell you why it's important to know the background. Some psalms don't have superscripts, but it assumes you know the whole Samuel story. When you know that David's, we know more about David than Jesus. And the reason is because of type of Christ. And do you notice also that we don't have many of Jesus' prayers? You think, if I want to learn to pray, why don't we have Jesus' prayers? You don't need them because we know exactly what Jesus prayed in the Psalms. That's Jesus' prayer book. And so whenever you're doing a psalm by David, you might find some context that'll fit. You don't say dogmatically this, but you can see where some of the metaphors come to life. To know where a metaphor comes from. Like poetry is difficult to read a poetry book. You have no idea where this person's coming from, and it's weird language. But when you're anchored in history, and the metaphors have meaning. That's why I always ask somebody, give a superscript for your poem, and then Karen's images had meaning last night, right? Okay, read the text.
So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him, everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him, and David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me. Then he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. The prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Herod.
Okay. All narrative has structure. All poetry has structure. If you know how something's structured, that is the key to meaning. So whenever I have a text, I want to know how was it put together, the big forest before the trees. So if you look at the bottom, I have a little outline. This is called the chiastic structure. Most movies are made chiastically. So when you're at the beginning of a movie, there's an opening scene. How do you know you're at the end of the movie? You have the same scene repeated, but it's been made new. It's been made new by a turning point in the movie, right? And people just do that naturally. So when you have a chiastic structure, you're always looking at the center line as the key. And then you're comparing and contrasting the A and the B's. Okay? If you have a structure that goes ABC, ABC, you're doing comparison and progression. Those are just the two basic things for narrative and poetry, and you can outline anything. So instead of a linear outline, if you even notice this in Paul, he's repeating himself a lot because he's Jewish. So instead of having 6 points, it's usually 3 points with a center. And you're always looking for the center. So here, what's the center of this story? Yes, he's escaping at the beginning, he's escaping at the end, in between it's bracketed, him dealing with his family, but what's in the center? A new spiritual family is born. Of all the discontent, those who are in debt, and those of bitter spirit coming to this cave. Now, next slide. Okay, this is going to be about mother-daughters eventually. Next. There's the doulam. So this is, that chart or map shows 13 years of David's life. That's the school to become Cain. It's pretty chaotic, doesn't it? Just running through your life. You ever wondered if your life has meaning? You'd be encouraged looking at David's life. So there's a doulam. Next slide. And so the cave is on the back side of those forested trees, and that picture is taken from the north. So it's about 5 miles from Bethlehem, about 12 miles from Jerusalem, and the place is replete with caves, and even today, the shepherds still use those caves for their sheep. Next slide. So in 1994, it was my passion to go find that cave and to read this poem back to David 3,000 years later. And tell him how thankful I was for this, because this poem has been a bit of shaped my own life. So I took three of my Hebrew buddies and Bruce Walke, a professor in 1994, in search of the cave. So one guy is a forest fireman fighter, so he's a good sense of geography. The other guy, Bernard Bell, is a scholar from Scotland who did geography, which means is mapping, surveying. Now he surveys. He surveys linear accelerators for the height of atoms, and he's brilliant anyway. So we go into this cave, we read the psalm, and as we're leaving, Jackson goes, "I don't think it's the right cave." And what? And then Bernard says, "Yeah, I don't think it was the right cave either." I go, "How do you know?" So we go to Jerusalem, and Bernard finds a Hebrew topo map. He goes, "Oh no, we were here, and the cave's just over here. We have to go back and do the whole ceremony again." So we went back into the ceremony again. But we told David we loved him. And we want to go back to where he'd written this life-shaping cave. Okay, next line. So Marilyn's going to read the whole psalm for us. You can do it from the PowerPoint. Stand up, Marilyn.
Not in Hebrew.
No, it's in English up there. Yeah, and I've tried to put it in the original word order so you can see how it's all the repetition. Okay, here we go.
With my voice to the Lord, I cry aloud. With my voice to the Lord, I appeal for grace. I pour out before him my complaint, my distress before him I declare. But my spirit fails within me. But you know my path. In the way where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. No one regards me. Escape has perished from me. No one seeks my soul. I cry aloud to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my ringing cry, for I have been brought very low. Deliver me from my pursuers, for they are too strong for me. Bring my soul out from prison, that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me.
Amen. Thank you. Next slide. So last night we saw that these are the motifs in a lament psalm. And if you know them, you can outline a lament psalm. You have a direct address, you, O Lord. The minute you have you, or O Lord, at the beginning, you know you're a lament. And then the lament is detailed. There's petition. The vow. Who remembers what the vow means? Yes. It doesn't mean I'll be a missionary in Africa if you save me. This means what God wants is a sacrifice of praise. You go back to the congregation and give thanks to God. So when God gave us Becky as a miracle, what was I supposed to do with that? I had to write a poem. I didn't learn that, though, until 16 years later. So I wrote poems for all my kids. And then the confidence is this abrupt change in mood where fear and doubt suddenly give way to a new orientation. And sometimes even you taste the future while you're still in the painful present. Do that verse that Paul writes in Philippians, be anxious for nothing, but by prayer and supplication, make your request known to God. And I'm going, that doesn't work for me. But then I realize he's a Jew, and he knew this. And he assumed his readers knew it, that how do you get through your anxiety? It's just not making a request. It's articulating the pain leads to the insight that then gives you the peace that surpasses comprehension. Now, you saw Karen's poem last night. It took a day for the second half of the poem to come. You guys just get an hour.
Huh. Okay, next slide. So I put the Hebrew up here, this is the first strophe. So a poem is made up of verses that either have, it always has either two or three verse lines. So the poet writes a line, and he's very concise. Every poetic line is either 7, 8, or 9 syllables in a song. So poetry, you don't say much. It's great, isn't it? He then repeats the line, and in the second line, he's repeating it, but he's putting a nuance in there, either contrasting it or magnifying it, and you're always looking at that second line, what's new in that line, to differentiate it. And this is where we get our dynamic movement of our spiritual mood. And then usually the next, when you have two or three verses, we have what's called a strophe. That just means turn. And it's usually a strophe that has some cohesion, a subject or whatever. And then the word turn, he turns to another thing. And then he turns to another one. So if you can say, what's the main idea of the poem? You're not going to find it because he's always turning. So here's the first strophe. Now, notice, every single line in Hebrew is only three words, where it takes more than that. So that's why I divided the spaces, or equivalent to the Hebrew words. So every single line is only three words. And he stays with this discipline. So this is important when you're in pain. The more painful David is, the more structured is his poetry. When you're in pain, you need order, structure to heal. You need just to know where to put one A, where to put B. And the tighter the structure, the better channel you have for your emotion, rather than just venting the tidal wave of nothingness, right? And articulation is your key to control emotion. When you name something, you're controlling it. If you can't name it, it controls you. That's why doctors name all the bones. They want to name your diseases. You know, zoology, every science is about naming. And emotions are the hardest thing to name. Okay, so next thing you notice, next slide, is in every single line, there is two I morphemes. Look at my I, me. So what's this? This is about David's cry is very personal. He feels vulnerable and alone. This is not where you want to be, but this is where he is. So he's not going to fake it and say, oh, dear God, wonderful being, ultimate concern, the ground of all life and love. It's all about me at this point. And so it's like what Karen said, you have to start where you are. So it's like where you are in the mountain. You have to find out, where is that place? Am I in a ravine? Am I in a dark spot? Am I depressed? Do I feel alone? He starts where he is. Next line. And you'll notice, normally in a lament poem, you would say you. But he can't do that, honestly. So it says, with my voice to the Lord. Because he feels the Lord distant. And he's third person. This is the guy that wrote the Psalms. This is what he says. Okay? But notice the progress he makes between verse 1 and 2. He makes progress. In verse 1, it's like he's shouting up the mountain, "To the Lord I cry with my voice." And then in verse 2, it's like, okay, I'm at the door and I'm knocking. I still don't see him, but I'm here. So at least he made the process. In one verse, he got up the mountain. Be before the Lord. Isn't that great? All you got to do is be attentive with poetry. It's not about being a scholar. It's just about observation and its compare and contrast. That's all it is. Next slide. Now, notice, now we're going to compare the verbs. In the A lines, the verbs are not articulate. You cry aloud is a cry of distress. To pour out is just a spend. By the way, pour out. Where did David get that? From Hannah. That's what Hannah did. Same verb. She spent all her bitterness, turned it into liquid, and poured it out as a drink offering to God. Did not hold back anything. That's the freedom you have in prayer. And you can do it in 7 verses. Think of that. It's like a time bomb, you know. Then the B lines, you'll notice, are articulate. He appeals for grace. He declares. So my wife is a preschool teacher. Okay? And what happens with preschool children when they're all emotional? And then she says, use your words. And so with the A lines, he kind of gets out a little bit of the emotion, and then he's able to use his words. It's like Hannah, right? Hannah could not articulate her words. The Spirit gave her, and then she can articulate. That's all in one strophe. Now that's worth the whole class, right? I mean, isn't this wonderful? Next slide. Okay, so that's his cry. Now he laments. Look how tight the structure is. We have 2 tricolons, 3 lines, 3 lines. In the middle is a double imperative holding it. I mean, we're totally symmetrical here. So what's his lament? What's the tension in his soul? Anybody? What really troubles him?
No one's there.
Huh?
No one's there.
And what's supposed to be true since he's king?
Everybody should be lying.
Yeah. He should have some friends. He's supposed to have a right-hand man. Everybody's supposed to seek him in prayer, not seek his life. Okay? What else is wrong in 3B?
God knew it.
Huh?
God knew and still let it
what,
happen.
Specifically, what does he know?
He knows the path that David's taking.
Okay, and if you look back at that map, his first path, he goes to the temple, and he gets the shewbread and Goliath's sword. And there, he gets betrayed by Doeg the Edomite. So Saul comes back, and Saddam Hussein kills the entire priesthood. And then he flees to the Philistine territory, thinking he won't be noticed. But it's like the Super Bowl champion going to the rival country and thinking the quarterback isn't going to be noticed. And he has to act like a madman to get out. And now he's in a cave alone. So it's like he said, God, you are sovereign. Go to the next slide. You're sovereign, and you know where I go. And yet it seems every path is a dead end with no escape. He's just being honest. Now, I've known women who got married. And so they pray before the guy they married, and then they find out it's a bad deal. So what happens there? God, you're sovereign. So your sovereignty is at stake here, and your faithfulness to me. So God has a legal obligation to save the king. I'm supposed to have a right-hand man of protection, like Jonathan. I'm in a cave completely alone. So are you blind? Look to the right and see. Now, we know theologically in our head these are not attributes of God, but you're supposed to address God in reality, the way it seems, to get him to change the situation. So don't use your head theology to bypass your emotions. Okay? You need to be honest. And then he does articulate his emotions. He says, I feel worthless. No one regards me. I feel hopeless. I feel there's no escape. And I feel abandoned. Now, for the Messiah to be abandoned, I mean, that's like, because God set it up that by answering the Messiah's prayers, that's what Psalm 2 is all about, I vindicate that you're my Messiah. And I'm on the run. And I'm homeless. So, okay, that's as honest as you can get, right? Didn't take many words to say all that. You can hold that in your hand and pray that pretty easily. All right. Next slide. So, if you'll notice, Karen's poem, she's like, he only has three words a line, too. Did the same thing David did. And I don't think she knew what she was doing, but it just, the same truths came out. Honesty, giving Tamar a voice, right? Tamar, princess of Israel, your beauty is a curse. That's a paradox, isn't it? Women want to be beautiful, and then what happens to beauty? Just another thing some man will use. Tamar, abandoned by God, crushed beneath a brother's weight. Boy, does that have multiple meanings. A pawn in her father's restoration. It's interesting. God uses David as a pawn later to do to him what he did to Uriah and to Tamar. Tamar, robes red, bleeding, screaming in grief for a champion, but God can't be bothered. Okay. Tamar, silent and alone, the scapegoat for the family's good. I always wondered what Christmas must have been like, or a holiday in the royal house. No one's talking. You have Absalom and Amnon, you know, supposed to exchange gifts, and Tamar is there. She's just silent, and who's giving her? Holidays must have been awful. Yeah, it wasn't Christmas yet, but, you know. Had Passover. Hanukkah. Yeah. And then, destined for ruin, struggling to carry the impossible weight of being expendable. You know, each line just gets heavier and heavier. Tamar. Every time you're using the word Tamar, which means princess, palm tree, beauty, it gets more tainted. There'll be no end to your grief. There'll be no justice for your pain. Healing is for husbands, fathers, and sons. And then, here's her punchline. She named herself. And then she sat. Okay, next slide. Now, this is Jesus' prayer book. So then you go through the psalm after you take it through David's life, and then we take it to Christ's life, and you say, okay, there was there a time in his life when there was a hidden trap for him, and there was no escape, and he has no one. Gethsemane. He had no friends to pray with him. No one came to his right hand. His path, just think of this, God's going to tell him, the devil is going to play every card in his hand for you. He's going to abuse you. He's going to beat you. They're going to strip you naked. I mean, it's as much sexual abuse as you can handle. You're going to be bloody raw. I'm going to abandon you that day. I have to do that. So David's story shapes Jesus' story. Okay? Now I'm discipling a young Christian, and I have to tell them, well, there may be a time in your life, if you're part of this pilgrimage, that you're going to feel abandoned and humiliated, and that God's not there. Part of the deal. But you're on a well-trodden path. You're on the carabiner. You're on the rope. Follow the guide. Huh? So for me, it wasn't as bad as this, but it was my dad. I'm 19. I'm excited about my new faith, and I lose my family. I got no family.
And Emily's family, her mother was kind of a hippie artist that divorced her husband and married a Jew who was a communist at one point. First date, the parents are smoking dope, and you know, and I'm taking this bride out of this atmosphere, and so I've got the left-wing communist society artist and my John Birch country club parents coming together for the wedding. We just had a quick little thing. They threw David out of the house for the rehearsal dinner when they let the pastor in the house. We had a quick little ceremony in Beverly Hills, and just a few hors d'oeuvres to say after, and then we went 400 miles away. The most painful thing for me was not me. It was my kids. All my kids are miracles. We didn't know if any of them were going to live. We prayed for 9 months. We have three gorgeous daughters. My parents never knew them. My daughter turned 16, not even a card. So my kids had no cousins. And that was the harder. This was the wedding day. It's my dad and mom. You could tell. When we're all together, Emily and I are beaming, and her parents and my parents are growling. And I said, you know what, we're just going to enjoy ourselves. Have a party. And anyway. Next slide. Okay, now, David repeats the cry. So it's the exact same verb in verse 1, but I'm going to teach you something. In Hebrew poetry, repetition is never pure repetition. That's why I don't like when we do praise choruses over and over again, because we're going nowhere, we're just going around the horn. When you have repetition in Hebrew, there is an ascent with new meaning. Okay? Same word, cry aloud. I cry aloud to you, I am. Oh, so by the way, a lot of times we have in the book, Bruce Waltke translates the meaning of the word Lord. There's different names for God, and they mean very different things. Elohim, the creator God, transcendent, all-powerful. Okay. But Yahweh is the word I am. That's the name he gave Moses. And it means, when God told Moses this, it's a verb, it's open-ended, and it means I am anything you need to be, and it's a dynamic thing that's going to do something new and exciting you never thought possible. So throughout Israel's history, they'll attach nouns to it as God does things in salvation history. So at the Exodus, God had never been a warrior before. I am as a warrior, or I am as a shield, I am as a rock. None of that is theory. It came out of their salvation history. So Jesus takes the name in John 7 times. I am the good shepherd. You know, I am the vine, the true one. I am the door. I am the life. And then he just flat out says it. Before Abraham was, and going me, I am. And that's why they stoned him. They knew what he was saying. So this is a very important name. When you make it Lord, and they make it lowercase capitals, it's a title. And titles distance you from the person. Right? This is the intimate title of God who comes into your world to be with you, to fulfill his promises for you. And so that's why Bruce translates it, I am. But you'll see it in your English Bibles is capital L-O-R-D. And then when it's lowercase Lord, that is Adonai, which means sovereign. Okay? So now you're just so equipped. It's a very intimate book. But notice here, verse 5, he cries aloud, but having lamented, something new has happened to him on the inside. He says, you're my refuge, my portion. Now, this is not head language. Now he feels this in the heart. Now, you have to know what the word portion means. Portion is land. Portion was the inheritance the tribes had. It's how God mediated his life. Every tribe had an inheritance except who? Levites. What was their portion?
The priesthood.
Huh?
Priesthood.
Well, what was the priesthood's portion? What was their inheritance?
Intimacy with God.
Huh?
Intimacy with God.
God. The Lord was their portion. So now David is homeless, and he feels like as intimate with God as a priest. hear my portion. That's new. That's exciting. Something's happened. He's homeless, but now he feels an intimacy, like Karen talked about, and she voiced her laments. Something new happened. And you can't explain it. It's mysterious. So the irony of the enemy that forces him out of the physical temple drives him into the spiritual temple of heaven itself, and he fills this new inheritance with God. Isn't that amazing? But notice, though he feels intimate with God, notice in verse 6, he still feels inadequate to face the enemy. So the word ringing cry is a stadium shout that's more intense than the first cry because he says, the enemy's stronger than me. So that's good news for me because I never feel adequate to preach or teach. And whenever I'm trying to prepare a sermon, I've done it for 43 years. Thursdays are always hell. And I always feel worthless. I always feel what I have on the paper is absolute crap. Is that okay to say what was retreat? It feels absolute garbage. I always call Karen and Elsie and say, pray for me, this is garbage. And then somehow God rescues it and Sunday's fun. And I thought, does it always have to be like birthing a baby? And going through labor pains and prayer and feeling worthless. And I just hate it. It's like, can't this be easier? And as I've gotten older, it's gotten harder. The highs and the lows. It's, you know, I'd rather write poetry. Okay, next slide. Okay, here's the final verse. Now notice, now he's lamented, he made a plea, he laments, he repeats his cry. Now he has a platform for his little petition. Bring my soul out of prison. That's an Exodus term, same word used in Exodus to bring me out. His prison is a cave, which feels like a grave. I tell you, being in that cave, you feel like you're in a grave. And why does he want to do that? He wants to pay his vows. Isn't that great? So do this so I can pay my vows to you. I want to give thanks publicly. And then notice, now here comes the confidence. Here's the vision that he gets. This is what's new. He just doesn't have confidence that he's going to be rescued by the skin of his teeth. He sees a coronation happen. The righteous surrounding him with shouts and deal bountifully. We can't even translate it. It's so wonderful. He sees his coronation as king in the surrounding. That saving the king out of this cave is going to have historic consequences. Like, how does David get an insight to be in a lousy cave and you realize it's going to change world history? What God does in that cave. Now, if you go back to the story, you see what happens. David prays the prayer. He tastes the future before it happens. And he looks out the cave and it happens. Here they come. Everybody's in distress and dead, discontented. 400 people find that cave. Here's the interesting thing. Saul has the CIA. He has all the army, all his generals. He can't find David. But everybody who's in pain and in debt, they find David. What do you think of that? Say they have a Jesus, right? King Herod wants to find that king born in a cave. He has all these women, he can't do it. But the wise man coming with a star, they just find somebody throws a little mic at first, boom, they find the king. And the only people at that cave are the shepherds and the wise men, and Mary and Joseph in that cave. So this is the culmination of this poem. It's Christmas reenacted. So all these poems, you see, shape history, and they shape your life. And this was my life. I have to say, my whole life, I only knew acceptance. I was the golden boy. I got straight A's to school. I never did anything wrong. I hated church kids because they got me in trouble. I thought things were going my church kids went. And so, but I found Christ, and it wasn't a problem because first it was Fellowship Christian Athletes, but when it took over my life, the rejection happened. And I'm a man pleaser. And I needed to understand rejection. So I lost my family. And that was painful. But what happened was, I had compassion for men. And I just started discipling men. I never had any brothers. That was painful, so I made brothers. And I found that the pain always opens up a door to your fertility. Now, in Karen's poem,
her second part, Tamar, princess of Zion, your beauty is so piercing it rends the heart of a sinful man. Tamar, Ezer, image bearer, crushed beneath another's sin, entrusted with another's restoration. Tamar, I see your robes divided. I see your blood flow down. Spend your grief fully, Tamar. As she was reading that, you can stay there. I thought she's describing Jesus. Yeah, next slide. Entombed in silence. Desolation. Now, the word desolation means it's a desolation so horrific it leaves the onlooker speechless. In Isaiah 53, that's the word used for Jesus on the cross. He was made desolate. And then Isaiah 54 opens, shout for joy, O desolate one, you who bore no children, for the sons of the desolate are more than the married women. And here's the paradigm from Tamar. The place where you became desolate is the place of your fertility in the new age. And that's where you birth children. I don't have many wounds. I have rejection. I've lost children. That's the area where I've been fertile. Not just with three daughters, but when I went to Romania, the sons of the poet, the spiritual sons, was named David and Jonathan. That was my son's name. The children of this little family had 17 kids in this little village of Simate. And I adopted them all in my heart. They were the same age as the kids we lost. And they became my family. We put several of them through college. It only cost $500 for the best college in a year. And they couldn't afford to go. And so I lost two kids, and I birthed a nation of kids. And I think you saw in Karen last night, your ability, her ability to minister to you was because she was made desolate. And it goes on for generation after generation. That's really good news. Okay, next slide. So now, I like the Tamar, yeah? But she couldn't have done that instantly. It took that dark night of the soul to give her that insight. Okay, next slide. So, you now get to hear Elsie's story of mothers and daughters.